the Musings on Sports podcast for June 28th, 2022. I'm Kelly Elbin, my co-host Bob Bupka. And Robert, while there are so many topics to discuss in the world of sports, first and foremost, one of us is celebrating a most special occasion today. My dear friend, happy birthday.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Elbin. You know, the older you get, the more you do appreciate the birthdays. And I always felt that if you could celebrate a birthday with friends, you know, that's great. If you could celebrate a birthday with family, that's great. And when you get to do what I have been able to do over the last couple of days, a combination of friends and family, it was just over the moon. And speaking over the moon, how about this, Kel? I get a letter on Saturday, and it says, happy 80th birthday. I passed 80 a couple of years ago, and it's not as bad as you think. Although at this age, you and I are still working, and sadly, so am I. Bob, you have been a great friend for a long time. I've enjoyed seeing your smiling face in our interviews. You have always done a terrific job, never embarrassed yourself or me, and I appreciate that. Barbara joins me in sending best wishes. Say hello to Janice. Have a fantastic day. Sincerely, Jack Nicklaus.
How incredible is that for you to be appreciated by Jack on such a special occasion? And the friendship that you and Jack and you and Janice and Jack have had for a number of years now. It's been so special, hasn't it?
It really has. And for somebody of his stature to take time out to acknowledge that it was my birthday. And you know what made it really extra special, if that's the right word. You know, it wasn't a form letter that Jack just puts his signature to and he gets mailed out. You know, I could tell by what was said, you know, this was handwritten by him. He put some thought into it. And I'm still blown away, and it's been several hours, several days now since I received that correspondence.
Well, Bob, I know that friendship, that relationship that you and Janice have enjoyed with Jack through the years means so much to you. And being with friends and family back home on the East Coast, it's got to be a very, very special time.
Well, it really does. And, you know, the older you get, the more you appreciate the little things. You know, having dinner at my brother's house, staying with my daughter, staying with my son. I mean, and the village of Sag Harbor, and maybe many of our listeners have heard of that. It's just an incredible place. This weekend, there were at least 50 yachts in the harbor over 200 feet long. So
how many of those were yours?
Yeah, I was just going to say, and none of those were mine. It reminded me, though, when the U.S. Open was here, Tiger did come and had his yacht Privacy parked in Sag Harbor. So in the mass interview, I raised my hand and I said, Tiger, how does it feel to have one of the smallest dinghies in the harbor? Because his boat was only 198 feet. But it was dwarfed by the biggest ships that were in there.
Well, you said something about the little things. And, you know, that old saying, don't sweat the small things or the little things. But the little things really, they do matter. You know, when we get to a certain age, I guess, as you said, but in life. And I think family is so important to you and has been for a long time. And you've been, Bob, you've been part of the golf family for a long time. And when I tell people about Bob Bupka, I said, well, you know, did you ever hear Bob Bupka? And people I talked to say, well, I'm not sure. I said, well, he's the guy for years on a Saturday afternoon. If you were listening to the radio, you would hear a report on the all sports station. This is Bob Bupka reporting live from Wingfoot. Tiger Woods has just birdied the 15th hole to take the lead in the U.S. Open. Bob Bupka reporting. And I said, you know, that's Bob Bupka on the scene, telling it like it is in terms of what's going on. But Bob, being a part of the golf and broadcasting family, it wasn't part of your birthright necessarily. You've got a fascinating story of how you even just got into broadcasting.
Yeah, and I don't want to bore our listeners, but I will
tell
I will say this much. I was in the Air Force, and I'm stationed down in Virginia, and I saw a notice on the bulletin board they were looking for volunteers to go to Sondestrom, Greenland. Now, of course, nobody wanted to go there, so they ponied up a pretty nice reward. They would cut 90 days off of your length of service. So I was quick to respond. I get to Greenland. I'm there maybe a couple of weeks. My roommate comes in and says, hey, Bob, you got to go down to see what that notice is on that bulletin board. I said, what is it? He says, they're auditioning for Armed Forces Radio. I said, radio? I don't know anything about radio. And the guy said, well, you got a pretty good voice. Maybe you can get it. Well, I do get accepted. I'm going to go into Armed Forces Radio. But the irony of all ironies, I'm writing a letter back to my mother in Sag Harbor. Dear Mom, guess what? I'm going into Armed Forces Radio. At the same time, a letter was coming to me from my mother. Dear Bob, you're not going to believe it. They're opening a radio station in Sag Harbor. Now, over the course of this past weekend, I still do work for that very same radio station. I went back to the studio, reminisced about how it was over 50 years ago when I started there. And it's a unique relationship because small radio stations, people don't last long. They either get fired or they move on to a bigger station. Well, neither one of those two things happened to me except, you know, obviously getting involved in golf and then moving on to other networks that I got to work for.
Great story. Fantastic story. Later on in Musings on this Musings on Sports podcast, we're going to hear from a guy who loves to play golf these days, but he was known a lot more as a terrific coach, Gary Williams, who led my Maryland Terrapins to the 2002 NCAA Men's Basketball National Championship, is going to be joining us. Bob, coaches are so important in the lifeblood of a team, of an individual. I was just thinking, I know you're not necessarily a hockey guy, but the Colorado Avalanche deservedly won the Stanley Cup. But I got to tell you, John Cooper, who is the coach of the Tampa Bay Lightning, what he has done with that organization. Now, they didn't win, but they were so banged up in the finals against an Avalanche team that, frankly, was a lot more talented. He had the All-Star center, Braden Point, with a torn quad, missed the last, I think, four games of the final series. But Cooper, a guy you probably wouldn't even know walking down the street, listen to this success story. He's the longest tenured coach in the National Hockey League, just finished his 10th year. Here are his seasons in exact order, but pretty close to it. Lost in the Stanley Cup Finals, lost in the Conference Finals, lost in the Conference Finals, and then in the 18-19 season, his team was really good the regular season, and they got bounced out by the Columbus Blue Jackets, swept in the first round of the Stanley Cup playoffs, and that kind of ignited them. They then won the Stanley Cup, won it again in the 2021 season, and came as close as you possibly could, forcing a game six. They were overmatched, but coaches are so important. They've been a big part of your life as well, Bob.
Yeah, it really has been. Coaches are the undercredited yeah. heroes. You know, they don't get everything they deserve. I mean, I've really become good friends with John Fields, the University of Texas golf coach, and what he's done with that program. And players are begging to go to University of Texas to play golf for John Fields. I mean, so coaches do make a difference. The only thing that any youngsters listening, and if they're about to go off to college or they're going into their freshman year of high school and they're going to be exposed to a brand new coach, the only advice I can give them is listen to what the coach has to say, because the coach only has your best interest at heart. And don't think you know it better than him, because there'll come a day when you realize you should have listened and you don't want it that way. Listen from the get-go, and your ability playing any sport will be, immensely enhanced.
Yeah, and coaches come in lots of forms. And I think about the struggles on Sunday that Lexi Thompson had at the KPMG Women's PGA Championship at Congressional around the corner from where I grew up Just couldn't get it done. Her putting really bedeviled her over those last nine holes. And then Sahith Theegala, who unfortunately just slipped out on 18, made double bogey. I think he took the lead going into that final hole at the Travelers Championship, ended up losing. I keep going back, Bob, to how do you close something? How do you get something done? You and I have been watching and covering golf for a long time. I go back to Bob Rotella working with Brad Faxon at the 1995 PGA Championship at Riviera outside of Los Angeles. Faxon had put so much pressure on himself to finish high in the championship that was the last qualifier to get on the Ryder Cup team that year. And essentially the night before the final round, Rotella told him, look, Brad, just go out and play like you don't even care. Just put everything else out of your mind. Just go out and play a round of golf. He goes out and shoots 63, finishes fifth, and makes the Ryder Cup team as an automatic qualifier. Those are the abilities of the coach, in that case, the sort of the psychological coach that can get you over that hump, just and sometimes by telling you what not to do.
Such good advice, Kelly. It's not the easiest thing to go out there with everything on the line and make believe you don't care. The only sad part that I feel when I look what happened to Theegala on at the Travelers Championship, leading going to the 72nd hole, doesn't get the job done. But the common reaction from golf fans, well, he got that close. He'll probably go on to win a lot of tournaments. There's no guarantee that he'll even ever get that close again. That's what makes winning so difficult. The players that are out there, they realize, wow, I'm in a golden position now to get this job done. And that ugly, ugly thought creeps into their head. I better get it done this time because I may never, ever have another chance. And there's been many a guy that has lost on the 72nd hole and never gone on to one victory on the PGA Tour. I had a dear friend, I mean, John Adams, a name that most people aren't familiar with, but he played in 457 PGA Tour events without a victory. 457. Now, how do you keep your confidence up when you never win? But you have to be confident, and that's all I can say. And going back to your advice, have fun. You know, even if you lose, if you're having fun, it's better than not having fun.
You brought up about the difficulty of winning. Xander Schauffele knows all about that, 3 years removed from winning. And yeah, Theegala had his struggles on 18, and that opened the door, and Xander finished it off. As good, we recognize Xander Schauffele, Ryder Cup player, really good player, et cetera. Bobby hadn't won in 3 years.
Olympic gold medal winner. I know. That's how tough it is. I mean, at the highest level right now, professional golf, there are more guys capable of getting the job done. Sometimes you need a lucky break. Sometimes, you know, who knows what goes into it. You know, you hit one shot during the course of the round and it could have bounced out of bounds, but it doesn't. It stays in bounds. And those are the little things that at the end of the day, it adds up to whether you win or you lose.
Well, Bob, happy birthday again. I know you're going to have a wonderful celebration with family and friends. Different kind of celebration that my friend Gary Williams had when he won the national championship at Maryland. And, God, it's been 20 years removed. The man could coach. Man's in the Hall of Fame now. We're going to hear from Gary in just a minute, right after our good friends at Titleist.
Titleist is the number one ball in golf. Yes, being number one is a number, and more players trust the Pro V1 or Pro V1X than all other golf balls combined. But being number one is more than a number. It's a mindset. It's a relentless mission to design and manufacture the best performing golf balls in the game, so you can chase whatever your number one is. Titleist, the number one ball in golf.
Welcome back to Musings on Sports. Kelly Elbin here, along with my co-host, Bob Bupka. And Bob, I'm particularly thrilled to welcome our guest this week because he led my Maryland Terrapins men's basketball team to its only national championship
He's a member of the Naismith Memorial Hall of Fame for basketball, and he's with us today. Coach Gary Williams, welcome to Musings on Sports.
Kelly, Bob, thanks for having me on your show. I'm looking forward to talking about some things that I think a lot of people might be interested in.
Well, that's for sure, and it really is an honor. You know, I've followed you for years and years and years. My forte is golf, but I love basketball. My brother was a high school basketball coach for 30 years, so has a fond part of my heart. And as I understand it, Gary, you were point guard and team captain under Maryland when you were playing at Maryland under Coach Bud Milliken. What led you to want to be a coach?
Well, I really loved basketball. I don't know. My grandfather wanted me to be a baseball player, and I like baseball, but basketball just, there was something different about it. The thing I looking back as a player, especially a young player, like in high school, the thing I liked about basketball was that you had to do everything if you were going to be any good. You had to rebound, you had to play defense, you had to score, how to handle the ball, you know, all those things. And, you know, there's a lot of times when you're playing baseball where you don't really get that involved with the game. If you're an outfielder, you might get one fly ball or no fly balls even during the game. And I always liked the concept that if you were on the court in basketball, you had to be doing something. You had to be active. And I really felt that was a good fit for me.
Gary, did you have a particular style of coaching that you employed early in your career, and who maybe was a big influence on you as a coach?
Well, my college coach, well, first, my high school coach, John Smith, who's still alive and lives in New Jersey, I think he kind of put the love of the game, you know, into me a little more, and made me work hard enough in school. I wasn't a good student, but made me work hard enough to get good enough grades to go to college, go to University of Maryland. And so I'll never forget that. And then my college coach, Bud Milliken, he played for Hank Iba, who got a lot of credit for founding man-to-man defense, team defense. And the principles I learned from him certainly helped whatever you do as a coach. But the guy that got me into college coaching was a fellow named Tom Davis, who was a great coach at Boston College, Lafayette College, Stanford, Iowa. You know, he was really good at every stop along the way. And I learned a lot from him about teaching. And as you guys know, when you're coaching, you're really, you might know all the basketball that there is out there, but if you can't teach it to your players, then it doesn't matter. You have to be a teacher. And he really got me to understand how important that was, how prepared for each practice, each game that you have to be in order to be successful. And also, he was a big zone defense, zone offense guy, and I learned a lot from him because we were basically all man-to-man when I was at the University of Maryland. So I had 7 years with Tom, six as an assistant at Lafayette and one at Boston College as an assistant. And during that time, I really learned quite a bit about the game, areas that, you know, I wasn't very familiar with.
Well, Hall of Fame Coach Gary Williams joining us on Musings on Sports. Coach, as Bob mentioned, you became a grad assistant at your alma mater at Maryland shortly after playing. Then you went back to your native New Jersey and coached at the high school level. Then you got in at American University eventually as the head coach. And then your second stop was at Boston College. You guided BC to the Sweet 16 in both the 82-83 season and the 84-85 season. That was, I guess, in a sense, the beginning of getting you on the national map. What stands out, Coach, from those two teams, those two seasons? And also, you were right in the heart of playing in the rugged Big East. What was that like back then?
Yeah, well, the Big East was, it's amazing when you look back at it. All those schools were there playing against each other a long time, like Seton Hall, St. John's, Providence, Georgetown, BC. They were all Villanova. You know, they were all playing against each other, but nobody ever put it together. And Dave Gavitt, who was a great basketball coach at Providence, AD there, came up with this idea, and schools were really reluctant to do it because, you know, there were schools there that really struggled financially to put together an athletic department. And so Dave convinced everybody, I think it was $25,000 was the magic number back then, to join the Big East. And at the same time, how about that today? And you know, at the same time, ESPN came along. They were looking for program, you know, and cable TV was new, 79-80. So the Big East jumped at the opportunity, and I think mainly because the Big East had all the eastern cities. They had D.C., Philly, New York, Boston, you know, a lot of people, and for selling advertising and things like that. And what that did for the Big East, it became a nationwide conference right away. You know, there was no gradual buildup. It just went nationwide with ESPN. And all of a sudden, 2 years later, they're playing the conference tournament in Madison Square Garden, where that's the best place to have a conference tournament. And that became such a big deal. And all of a sudden, you know, there's Georgetown winning a national championship. There's Villanova in 85 winning a national championship. And, you know, that really helped basketball across the country. And it made, you know, different conferences have to go to work and make their conferences better because of what the Big East accomplished in basketball. And, you know, at BC, I was very fortunate. I followed Tom Davis at BC and inherited a very good team with really veteran players, good players. I had a point guard named Michael Adams who played 11 years in the NBA. He was about 5'10", made the NBA All-Star team, just a tremendous competitor, tremendous player. Kind of got overlooked because Patrick Ewing and Chris Mullin were the two big names in the Big East then, and, you know, along with other really good players. And Carl Washington was playing point guard at about the same time at Syracuse. So Michael had to fight his way like he did, you know, his whole career because he was so small for a basketball player. And he made us a good team. We lost to Ralph Sampson and Virginia in 83, in the 82-83 season, out in Utah, and we lost 95-92 in a great game. And the next game for Virginia, they lost to NC State, and that was the year Galvano won the NCAA championship in 83. And then the 85 team, Michael basically, you know, a lot of those guys had graduated by then. Michael Adams was a senior, and he basically just took the team and put it on his back. And We had some really great competitors on that team. Dominic Presley out of Mackin High School in D.C. was a freshman, but a great player. People like Terrence Talley, you know, just guys that worked really hard. Roger McCrudy that, you know, wanted to win. And, you know, they accepted coaching. They accepted the fact that Michael was going to be a guy and he was going to lead us. And we lost that. That's the year the Big East had three teams in the Final Four. They had St. John's, Villanova, and Georgetown. And we lost on the last second shot to Memphis to go to the Elite Eight. And, you know, it would have been amazing to have four teams in the Big East, but in the NCAA tournament, but it didn't work out that way.
Well, it was an amazing, as you outlined, an amazing era for the Big East from the start with Mr. Gavitt when he put it all together. You had a wonderful run at BC. You were 3 years at Ohio State. The Maryland job opened up, Coach. Maryland, at the time you took the job, let's be honest, it was still struggling from the passing of Len Bias from a drug overdose. Basketball program, in fact, was on probation. Was it just the draw for you to return to your alma mater? Was it just too strong, even with those issues in College Park at that time?
Well, you know, there were a couple things involved there. When I left Maryland, I had been a graduate assistant, as you said, in 1 year. And I became a JV high school coach back in New Jersey, in Camden, New Jersey. And there was no way I ever thought I'd be a college coach, let alone, you know, get back to Maryland in the ACC back then. So things worked out, you know, got jobs, got to Ohio State. And Ohio State was a great job. It was probably the best job, you know, in terms of everything available. You know, football is really big there, but in terms of finances and things like that, you didn't have to worry about too many things at Ohio State. But when Bias had died, as you mentioned, and then there was problems with the interim coach. And so in 1889, the job opened up, and it's one of those things where I'm not sure how clearly I was thinking, but at the time, I just thought it was something that, you know, I kind of owed to school. They gave me my education. They gave me a chance to play basketball in college. And so it wasn't that hard of a decision. But if I would have known how difficult it was going to be those next 3 years or so, I'm not sure I would have done it. But, you know, you don't get takeovers. And, you know, it's it worked out overall. But it was probably the most difficult time I ever had as a coach from 99 to about 2000 89 to about 93. They were very difficult years.
Yeah, I know they were. But you were resilient. You made it through that. Ultimately, led to the mountaintop in 02. And I got to ask you though. No visit with you would be complete without talking about your very intense style on the bench. You had. Coach, I can still see you with the hands on the hips, the big stare, a lot of sweating. There's some cursing from what I understand. But at the same time, and I got to read this to you. I love the words of Juan Dixon, your beloved point guard on your national championship team, in the foreword to your book, Sweet Redemption. Juan wrote, "When people see Coach on the sideline during games, they think he looks like a nut they could never get along with. They are wrong. He is one hell of a guy with a great sense of humor. Every coach does it his own way, and hollering is his style. What people don't understand is that he is a great teacher and a tremendous motivator. The most important thing he taught me is how to be a winner. You have to hate to lose. He helped me become stronger mentally." I've got to imagine words like that from former players must be a pretty cool thing.
Yeah, I think a lot of people know the Juan Dixon story. Nobody ever achieved more than Juan did. From his background, his personal life growing up to where he became, MVP of the Final Four. I guess it was the ultimate. That so many awards along the way. But the big thing was when I don't know where that came from when I coached, because when I played back in those days, you weren't allowed to even look at a referee. You couldn't say anything. My coach would have yanked me right out of the button. Would have yanked me right out of the game if anybody on the team would have done that. And so all of a sudden, here I am coaching. And, like, I guess it was from, you know, I wanted to control. A lot of coaches are control freaks. And I wanted to control the team. So I guess I thought I could get that by yelling. You know, that would help things out. But looking back, I don't know how I did it, but the amazing thing about it was, to me, is 10 minutes before the game, I was fine. 10 minutes after the game, I was fine, because you had to do a press conference in the ACC. 10 minutes, you could go in the locker room for 10 minutes, and you had to be right in the press room. And so you had to come down, because you didn't want to say anything that would hurt the team or hurt yourself in those situations. So, I would like to think if I came back and coached now, I wouldn't quite be that way, but I wanted the players to know that I really cared about winning. And sometimes, you see some teams that look very talented, but they're not that motivated to win. And a part of winning is that fear of losing. You know, you just can't stand losses. And as you coach, you really understand that the losses became a lot worse than the highs of winning. When you won a game, after a while, it was just a relief and you moved on to the next game. When you lost a game, That just ate at you until you got a chance to play that next game. So I think that was part of it. I'd do anything not to lose. Hopefully that gets through to the players. And, you know, I wasn't always proud of what I said or anything like that. But with your players, they know you from practice. They know you from being in the office, stopping in, just shooting the breeze for a little while. And it might not even be about basketball. It just might be about life, the struggles that they go through as college students, things like that. And I think by the time we got ready to play a game, we were all on the same page. And that was the key, because obviously, you know, players would get upset at you as a coach, but if you had everything under control and ready to go by the time you played the next game, then those things were all motivation to be as good as you possibly can.
We're talking with Gary Williams, legendary basketball coach. And Gary never coached, but when I look at the ACC, I always in my head broke it down to three categories, X's, O's, and recruiting. And it certainly couldn't have been easy going up against Coach K at Duke, Dean Smith at North Carolina. I mean, high school players after high school players. Oh, yeah, I want to go to Duke. I want to go to North Carolina. Recruiting is such an integral part of being a successful basketball coach. Was that one aspect that you enjoyed, or was it one that you didn't enjoy?
Well, I'm not sure anybody really totally enjoyed recruiting. And in the ACC, as you mentioned, you had Duke and Carolina. Well, Duke and Carolina, if you ask people, especially during those times, the early 90s and into the 2000s, name two of the five best programs in the country, they probably named Duke and Carolina most of the time as two of the five. And so you were recruiting against them. And, you know, they would get the they could – I'm not saying they could just tell a kid, well, we want you, so you got to come to Duke or come to Carolina. But it was close. It was close, believe me. And they could recruit nationally. If you were – say you were in California and – you saw the ACC on television, whatever, and you say, well, I might really like to play in the ACC. Well, a lot of those kids would look at Duke and Carolina and say, well, at least I looked at the ACC. I might not go there, but I looked at them. So the other schools in the ACC had to fight that. When we won in 2002, won the national championship, we were the only team outside the state of North Carolina in the ACC to win a national championship. And that's how dominant. That was mostly Duke and Carolina, and NC State won it a couple of years. But, you know, that was what you faced, coaching outside the state of North Carolina in the ACC. It was kind of a unique conference. And so that's what we tried to do. We tried to recruit good enough players to compete against them. And back then, and I really loved this part of it, which you don't have as much anymore, you could get a good high school player, and he could get better. He had time to get better. He wasn't looking to leave in a year. He wasn't looking, you know, to transfer to another school. He wanted to play for the school he went to. And, you know, all the coaches that coached during that era say the same thing. What a great time that was, because you could actually coach. A lot of coaching now is making sure the players stay happy where they are instead of trying to really push them, because if you really push them, sometimes, you know, they don't like that. And right away, with the way things are now, especially with the transfer portal, they're jumping into the transfer portal, taking the easy way out instead of fighting and getting better.
You know, Coach, great moments are often, unfortunately, the result of lows. I can remember watching, much less you being there, when you had the huge lead over Duke in the national semifinal in 2001, up 22, and you ended up losing by 11. And I know you had a strong returning team coming back, but how long did it take you? How long did it take the team to get over that devastating loss and then start to put the planning together for what ultimately would be Maryland's, and to this point, lone national championship?
Well, Maryland had never been in the Final Four before 2001 when we got there. And so it was a completely new experience with the media and all those things. It's so different than anything else you do as a college basketball coach. And we went out and we played great. The first half, we were, especially the first 15 minutes of the half, we played as good as we had played all year. And we were a good basketball team. We were talented. And so was Duke. Duke had Battier, and, you know, they won the national championship the next game against Arizona. So it wasn't like it was a bad team or anything from Duke, but we were up 22 in the first half. They cut it to 11, I think it was, at halftime. And it was a war the second half, and it got very physical, you know, and some, you know, the Maryland side of things, we thought there were some things that, you know, didn't go the way we felt they should have gone. And all of a sudden, you know, you lose that game. And what I was worried about after the game, that since that was an accomplishment for the team that hadn't been done before at Maryland, our players coming back the following year would be satisfied. In other words, they had reached a great height to get to the Final Four. And, you know, but so we took a couple of weeks off, but I knew we were going to be pretty good the next year, because that first week after we were back, our players on their own had gotten into the weight room and started working very hard on their own without me pushing them or anything like that. And so I knew we had a chance because we had, you know, several of those guys back. We lost a couple really good players off the team, but we were going to be good. I knew that. And so as far as getting over it, I never got over it. You know, you never get over that. That game comes up every once in a while when you're driving down the road and whatever. And the one thing about coaching, which I'm not sure everybody realizes, is, and I said this before, the losses, you know, are much more, stay with you a lot longer than any great win. And, you know, that certainly was a tough loss for us. But what we did the following year, you know, kind of at least put that in the back of my mind, that loss in the Final Four.
Well, for our listeners that may not realize, Kelly's dad, Max, was past president of the PGA of America. So I'm going to let him close out by asking you, Coach, about your golf game.
Yeah, Kelly, go ahead.
Well, I know Coach can play. I know he's a good player at a couple of tough golf courses, at Burning Tree, where my dad was for a long time, and at Congressional. Coach, what do you think of the changes that they made at Congressional? We've got a whole bunch of PGA of America championships coming out there, starting with the KPMG Women's. You like what they've done?
Well, I think that's why they did it, to get to attract those tournaments. They have the Ryder Cup, I think it's 2037. And,
right.
There's a tournament coming up this month, right there, a big women's tournament. So the changes were made, you know, like a lot of modern changes. They take out most of the trees that were there. It was an old traditional Eastern course at Congressional, and I kind of missed that, but at the same time, the new course is great. If you're a really good player, I think you like it, because they've done some things, some elevation changes with the fairways and the greens that make it very difficult to play, or at least harder to play than it was, and it was a very difficult course before. So
yeah,
in my age, it's become a battle now just to finish 18, but I think the members really like the changes overall, and it's a great place. You know, it's one of the great courses in the country, Burning Tree. Your dad, how many years was your dad the head pro?
He was the head professional for 50 years. How about that?
Yeah. I mean, nobody. And they're hard jobs. You know, trying to keep everybody happy. Yeah. I mean, that's. You know, and everybody has their own ideas about what the golf shirt should be, what the boots should be like, and all that stuff. So, to do it 50 years just tells you something about your dad. You know, what a great, great man he was. And, you know, people there still talk about him, and, you know, there's some great stories. So, you know, I've been very fortunate to play, you know, really good courses in the Washington area, and there are certainly two of them.
Hey, before we let you go, I have to ask you, and you kind of hinted at it earlier in terms of pushing players and the concern about them getting into the transfer portal, et cetera. John Feinstein was nice enough to be on Musings on Sports with us a while back. He referred to the current situation in college sports as nothing more than chaos because of the transfer portal, because of the kind of the uncontrolled name, image, and likeness situation. I can only imagine what you would be like as a coach right now. But I could imagine that. How do you think you would handle a situation like this if you were the coach today? You saw, for example, Jay Wright at Villanova said, you know, I'm done, and he quit at a time when I think it shocked a lot of people. How do you think you would handle it, Gary, being a coach in the situation as it is now?
Yeah, I was surprised at Jay Wright resigning as much as anybody, because he's at the peak of his game right now. You know, as a coach, what he's done is incredible. And, you know, that opened some eyes when Jay decided to stop coaching. But the problem became, as basketball and football started to sign all these big contracts, you know, parents saw the money involved. And, you know, for a kid with no money, you get a full scholarship. It means room, board, book, tuition, and fees, which is great, but it does not put any money in your pocket. And a lot of these kids got on campus and they were living a very good life. They couldn't do anything besides, you know, practice and go to school because they had no money. And, you know, obviously some schools would cheat, give players money. But basically kids had no money. And so the NCAA just refused for a long time to look at basketball and football differently than the other sports. All the money made from those TV contracts that we all read about in football and basketball, that goes to running the whole athletic department. That money just doesn't go to football and basketball, and it's enabled schools to have great athletic departments, great programs for women, just like for men. And, you know, all of a sudden, some people started saying, and the politicians got involved, saying, why don't these kids get a piece of the pie? Why don't they get some of the money? So a couple states, California, I think, led the way, passed a rule saying that players could get paid by, you know, as long as it wasn't considered, you know, a direct payment to go to the school. Well, we all know how that works. And, you know, right where it is right now, unfortunately, some kids are getting, you know, $200,000, $400,000 in basketball to play for a year. And they say it's because of their image and likeness and name and all that. But the schools want to win. And, you know, these kids are getting the money without having to do a whole lot, you know, to get the money. So that's what happened. And then coupled with the transfer portal, where now it used to be where a player had to sit out a year if he wanted to transfer. He'd go to the next school, sit out a year, because what nobody talks about is you usually lose credits. When you transfer, you lose some of the credits you had at your school. And so sitting out that year, you could catch up and, you know, have a really good chance to graduate. Well, I don't think too many people are worried about that right now. And what happens with the transfer portal is you go into the portal and you just wait there and you see who wants to give you the most money to go to their school. And it's basically legal. In other words, but there's bidding wars going on for some of these great players that go into the portal, which I'm not sure I would have been handled really well. And you know, kid works hard. You work hard with the player, making them better. And all of a sudden, for no reason at all, and the kid might not even, you know, have problems where he is with the school. But he's being told by his agent, which is legal now, that players can have agents in college, that you should go into the portal because you can make a lot more money if you go into the portal. So that's where we are right now. The NCAA is desperately trying to find a way to make it equitable because it's not equitable. Some schools have better ways to raise money to attract these kids into their program. And it's kind of like no rules right now. Nobody should. If you polled 20 major Division I basketball coaches, okay, what are the NIL rules? Nobody really has a grasp on the rules. So some way, somehow, That's got to be changed where there are at least guidelines of what you can do and what you can't do.
Yeah, I think that Wild West effect is it's very clear, whether it's basketball or football. Coach, I want to thank you so much for your time. Before you go, just what was the feeling when you knew you had won a national championship on the bench there in Atlanta and you had reached the mountaintop and the clock was ticking down? How did it feel?
We were up 10 or 11, 12, I guess. So that last minute, we knew we were going to win. And it's a great feeling. And, you know, you think about all the people responsible for getting there and how fortunate you are to get there. Because we all know a lot of great coaches that never got to the Final Four, never got a chance to win a national championship. And so, to finally get it, I was 57 years old, and you know, I started coaching when I was 23, and so to get there, it took a while, but it was certainly worth it. And, you know, people like Dave Gavitt, my high school coach, people that I mentioned before, you know, certainly helped me get there. Tom Davis, and you know, those names all came through my mind at the time, and you know, just I was so happy for the school. The state of Maryland, you know, it was a great thing for everybody involved. So that's a positive memory that I'll have, you know, for the rest of my life.
Well, Coach, I never had the talent to play big-time basketball, but I often fantasized about it, and I want to say thank you and leave you with one thought. Put me in, Coach. I don't smoke.
That's right. Yeah, everybody wants to be. Everybody wants to play. That's you know. It's like you always tell the players, like, hey, you're going to determine your playing time. It's not me. It's on you. You know, how well you play in practice. And hopefully, I was able to do that with my players, and everybody had a fair shot. And you know, certainly in your case, Kelly, I would have made sure you got on the court, believe me.
Well, right after Mr. Bupka, that's for sure. Coach Gary Williams, thank you so much for joining us on Musings on Sports. Best of luck and continue your work at the University of Maryland, and we'll hope to see you on the golf course before too long.
That'd be great. I appreciate you having me on. Thank you.
Today, there are smarter phones, smarter cars, smarter everything. So Bridgestone Golf's engineers thought, why not a smarter golf ball? Introducing the new Tour B, with a smart reactive IQ cover that delivers more power off your driver, more control off your wedges. Try Bridgestone's new Tour B with reactive IQ cover, the smarter tour ball.
Really enjoyed hearing and talking with Coach Williams, Bob. He's a fiery guy. And very passionate about the game of basketball. He's really had a lifelong love affair with that game. How great to be passionate about something and be good at it for almost your entire life, huh?
Yeah, fantastic. And that would be the word I would use. Fantastic. Celebrating a birthday, like I said, first with friends and family combined, and now being able to do it on Musings on Sports. Wow. It doesn't get much better than this. And Jack and Barbara, I thank you very much.
Well, again, happiest of birthdays to you, Bob. Happy 4th of July to everyone. By the time our next podcast, the 4th will have gone by. Hope everyone has a wonderful week and a wonderful Monday on the 4th. Want to thank Coach Gary Williams for joining us. Look forward to having all of you again here together next week as we start to look ahead to the 150th Open Championship. Please listen to Musings on Sports wherever you enjoy your podcast. For my birthday boy buddy, Bob Bupka, Kelly Elbin, thanks for joining us on Musings on Sports.